Part 3. The House of False Gods. XIII. Who are you? Ritual. Old friend. Horus opened his eyes, smiling as he saw blue sky above him. Pink and orange-tinged clouds drifted slowly across his vision, peaceful and relaxing. He watched them for a few moments and then sat up, feeling wet dew beneath his palms as he pushed himself upright. He saw that he was naked, and as he surveyed his surroundings, he lifted his hand to his face, smelling the sweet scent of the grass and the crystal freshness of the air. A vista of unsurpassed beauty lay before him. Towering snow-capped mountains draped in a shawl of pine and fir. Magnificent swathes of emerald green forests as far as the eye could see, and a wide river of foaming, icy water. Hundreds of shaggy-coated herbivores grazed on the plain, and wide pinioned birds circled noisily overhead. Horus sat on the low slopes of the foothills at the base of the mountains, the sun warming his face and the grass wondrously soft beneath him. "So that's it, then," he said calmly to himself. "I'm dead." No one answered him, but then he hadn't expected them to. Was this what happened when a person died? He dimly remembered someone teaching him of the ancient unbelief of heaven and hell, meaningless words that promised rewards for obedience and punishment for wickedness. He took a deep breath, scenting the aroma of good earth, the fragrances of a world unchecked and untamed, and of the living things that covered the landscape. He could taste the air and was amazed at its purity. Its crispness filled his lungs like sweet wine. But how had he come here, and where was here? He had been... where? He couldn't remember. He knew his name was Horus, but beyond that he knew only fragments and dim recollections that even now grew faint and insubstantial the more he tried to hold on to them. Deciding that he should try to find out more about his surroundings, he rose to his feet, wincing as his shoulder pulled tight, and he saw a spot of blood soak through the white woolen robes he found himself wearing. Hadn't he been naked a second ago? Horus put it from his mind and laughed. "There might be no hell, but this feels like heaven right enough." His throat was dry, and he set off towards the river, feeling the softness of the grass through newly sandaled feet. He was further away than he thought, the journey taking him longer than expected. But he didn't mind. The beauty of the landscape was worth savoring, and though something insistent nagged at the back of his mind, he ignored it and carried on. The mountains seemed to reach the very stars, their peaks lost in the clouds and belching noxious fumes into the air as he gazed up at them. Horus blinked. The afterimage of dark smoke, wreathed peaks of iron and cement, burned onto his retinas like a spliced frame of harsh interference dropped into a mood window. He dismissed it as the newness of his surroundings and headed across the swaying plains of tall grass, feeling the bones and waste of uncounted centuries of industry crunching beneath his feet. Horus felt ash in his throat, now needing a drink more than ever, the chemical stink growing worse with each step. He tasted benzene, chlorine, hydrochloric acid, and vast amounts of carbon monoxide, lethal toxins to any but him, it seemed, and briefly wondered how he knew these things. The river was just ahead, and he splashed through the shallows, enjoying the biting cold as he reached down and scooped a handful of water into his cupped palms. The icy water burned his skin, molten slag dripping in caustic ropes between his fingers, and he let it splash back into the river, wiping his hands on his robe, which was now soot-stained and torn. He looked up and saw that the glittering quartz mountains had become vast towers of brass and iron, wounding the sky with gateways like vast maws that could swallow and vomit forth entire armies, Streams of toxic filth poured from the towers and poisoned the river, the landscape around it withering and dying in an instant. Confused, Horus stumbled from the river, fighting to hold on to the verdant wilderness that had surrounded him, and to hold back the vision of this bleak land of dark ruin and despair. He turned from the dark mountain, the cliff of deepest red and blackened iron, its top hidden in the high clouds above, and its base girded with boulders and skulls. He fell to his knees, expecting the softness of the grass, but landing heavily on a fractured hard pan of ash and iron, swirling vortices of dust rising up in great storms. "What's happening here?" shouted Horus, rolling onto his back and screaming into a polluted sky, striated with ugly bands of ochre and purple. He picked himself up and ran as though his life depended on it. He ran across a landscape that flickered from one of aching beauty to that of a nightmare in the space of a heartbeat, his senses deceiving him from one second to another. Horus ran into the forest. The black trunks of the trees snapped before his furious charge, images of lashing branches, high towers of steel and glass, great ruins of mighty cathedrals, and rotted palaces left to crumble under the weight of the ages dancing before his eyes. Bestial howls echoed across the landscape, and Horus paused in his mad scramble as the sound penetrated the fog in his head, the insistent nagging sensation in the back of his mind recognizing it as significant. The mournful howls echoed across the land, a chorus of voices reaching out to him, and Horus recognized them as wolf howls. He smiled at the sound, dropping to his knees and clutching his shoulder as fiery pain lanced through his arm and into his chest. With the pain came clarity, and he held on to it, forcing the memories to come through force of will. Howling wolf voices came again, and he cried out to the heavens, "What's happening to me?" The trees around him exploded with motion, and a 100-strong pack of wolves sprang from the undergrowth, surrounding him, with their teeth bared and eyes wide. Foam gathered around exposed fangs, and each wolf bore a strange brand upon its fur, that of a black, double-headed eagle. Horus clutched his shoulder, his arm numb and dead as though it was no longer part of him.
"Who are you?"
asked the closest wolf. Horus blinked rapidly as its image fizzled like static, and he saw curves of armor and a single staring cyclopean eye.
"I am Horus," he said.
"Who are you?"
repeated the wolf.
"I am Horus," he yelled. "What more do you want from me?"
"I do not have much time, my brother,"
said the wolf, as the pack began circling him.
"You must remember before he comes for you. Who are you?"
"I am Horus, and if I am dead, then leave me be," he screamed, surging to his feet and running onwards into the depths of the forest.
The wolves followed him, loping alongside him and matching his steady pace as he lurched randomly through the twilight. Again and again, the wolves howled the same question until Horus lost all sense of direction and time. Horus ran blindly onwards until he finally emerged from the tree line above a wide, high-cliffed crater gouged in the landscape and filled with dark, still water. The sky above was black and starless, a moon of purest white shining like a diamond in the firmament. He blinked and raised a hand to ward his eyes against its brightness, looking out over the black waters of the crater, certain that some unspeakable horror lurked in its icy depths. Horus glanced behind him to see that the wolves had followed him from the trees, and he ran on as their howling followed him to the edge of the crater. Far below, the water lay still and flat like a black mirror, and the image of the moon filled his vision. The wolves howled again, and Horus felt the yawning depths of the water calling out to him with an inevitable attraction. He saw the moon and heard the company of wolves give voice to one last howled question before he hurled himself into the void. He fell through the air, his vision tumbling and his memory spinning. The moon, the wolves, Lupercal, Luna, wolves. Everything snapped into place, and he cried out,
"I am Horus of the Lunar Wolves, War Master and Regent of the Emperor, and I am alive!"
Horus struck the water, and it exploded like shards of black glass. Flickering light filled the chamber with a cold glow, the cracked stone walls limned with crawling webs of frost, and the breath of the cultists feathering in the air. Aksub had painted a circle with 8 sharp points around its circumference, on the flagstones in quicklime. The mutilated corpse of one of the Davinite priestess's acolytes lay spread-eagled at its center. Erebus watched carefully as the priestess's lodge thralls spread around the circle, ensuring that every stage of the ritual was enacted with meticulous care. To fail now, after he had invested so much effort in bringing the War Master to this point, would be disastrous, although Erebus knew that his part in the War Master's downfall was but one of a million events set in motion thousands of years ago. This fulcrum point in time was the culmination of billions of seemingly unrelated chains of circumstance that had led to this backwater world that no one had ever heard of. Erebus knew that this was all about to change. Davin would soon become a place of legend. The secret chamber in the heart of the Delphos was hidden from prying eyes by potent magic and sophisticated technology received from disaffected Mechanicum adepts, who welcomed the knowledge the word-bearers could give them, knowledge that had been forbidden to them by the Emperor. Akshab knelt and cut the heart from the dead acolyte, the lodge priestess expertly removing the still-warm organ from its former owner's chest. She took a bite before handing it to Sepher, her surviving acolyte. They passed the heart around the circle, each of the cultists taking a bite of the rich, red meat. Erebus took the ghastly remains of the heart as it was passed to him. He wolfed down the last of it, feeling the blood run down his chin and tasting the final memories of the betrayed acolyte as the treacherous blade had ended her life. That betrayal had been offered unto the architect of fate, this bloody feast to the blood god, and the unlovely coupling of the doomed acolyte with a diseased swine had called upon the power of the Dark Prince and the Lord of Decay. Blood pooled beneath the corpse, trickling into channels cut in the floor before draining into a sinkhole at the center of the circle. Erebus knew that there was always blood. It was rich with life and surged with the power of the gods. What better way was there of tapping into that power than with the vital substance that carried their blessing? "Is it done?" asked Erebus. Akshab nodded, lifting the long knife that had cut the heart from the corpse.
"It is. The power of the ones who dwell beyond is with us, though we must be swift."
"Why must we hurry, Akshab?" he asked, placing his hand upon his sword. "This must be done right, or all our lives are forfeit."
"I know this," said the priestess. "There is another presence near. A one-eyed ghost who walks between worlds and seeks to return the son to his father."
"Magnus, you old snake," chuckled Erebus, looking up towards the chamber's roof. "You won't stop us. You're too far away, and Horus is too far gone. I have seen to that."
"Who do you speak with?"
asked Akshab. "The one-eyed ghost. You said there was another presence near."
"Near, yes,"
said Akshub.
"But not here."
Tired of the old priestess's cryptic answers, Erebus snapped, "Then where is he?" Akshub reached up and tapped her head with the flat of her blade.
"He speaks to the sun, though he cannot yet reach him fully. I can feel the ghost crawling around the temple, trying to break the magic, keeping his full power out."
"What?" cried Erebus.
"He will not succeed,"
said Akshab, walking towards him with the knife outstretched.
"We have spirit walked in the realm beyond for thousands of years, and his knowledge is a paltry thing next to ours."
"For your sake, it had better be, Akshab." She smiled and held the knife out.
"Your threats mean nothing here, warrior. I could boil the blood in your veins with a word, or rip your body inside out with a thought. You need me to send your soul into the world beyond, but how will you return if I am dead? Your soul will remain adrift in the void forever. and you are not so full of anger that you do not fear such a fate."
Erebus did not like the sudden authority in her voice, but he knew she was right, and decided he would kill her once her purpose was served. He swallowed his anger and said, "Then let us begin."
"Very well,"
nodded the priestess, as Sepher came forward and anointed Erebus's face with crystalline antimony. "Is this for the veil?"
"Yes," said Akshub. "It will confound his senses, and he will not see your likeness. He will see a face familiar and beloved to him."
Erebus smiled at the delicious irony of the thought, and closed his eyes as Sepher daubed his eyelids and cheeks with the stinging silver-white powder.
"The spell that will allow your passage to the void requires one last thing,"
said Akshub. "What last thing?" asked Erebus, suddenly suspicious.
"Your death,"
said Akshub, slashing her knife across his throat. Horus opened his eyes, smiling as he saw blue sky above him. Pink and orange-tinged clouds drifted slowly across his vision, peaceful and relaxing. He watched them for a few moments and then sat up, feeling wet dew beneath his palms as he pushed himself upright. He saw that he was fully armored in his frost-white plate, and as he surveyed his surroundings, he lifted his hand to his face, smelling the sweet scent on the grass and the crystal freshness of the air. A vista of unsurpassed beauty lay before him. Towering snow-capped mountains draped in a shawl of pine and fir, magnificent swathes of emerald-green forests as far as the eye could see, and a wide river of foaming, icy water. Hundreds of shaggy-coated herbivores grazed on the plain, and wide-pinioned birds circled noisily overhead. Horus sat on the low slopes of the foothills at the base of the mountains, the sun warming his face and the grass wondrously soft beneath him.
"To hell with this," he said as he got to his feet. "I know I'm not dead. So what's going on?"
Once again, no one answered him, though this time he had expected an answer. The world still smelled sweet and fragrant, but with the memory of his identity came the knowledge of its falsehood. None of this was real. Not the mountains, or the river, or the forests that covered the landscape, though there was something oddly familiar to it. He remembered the dark iron backdrop that lay behind this illusion, and found that if he willed it, he could see the suggestion of that nightmarish vision behind the beauty of the world laid out before him. Horus remembered thinking, a lifetime ago it seemed, that perhaps this place might have been some netherworld between heaven and hell, but now laughed at the idea. He had long ago accepted the principle that the universe was simply matter, and that which was not matter was nothing. The universe was everything, and therefore nothing could exist beyond it. Horus had the wit to see why some ancient theologian had claimed that the warp was in fact hell. He understood the reasoning, but he knew that the Empyrean was no metaphysical dimension. It was simply an echo of the material world, where random vortices of energy and strange breeds of malign Xenos creatures made their homes. As pleasing an axiom as that was, it still didn't answer the question of where he was. How had he come to this place? His last memory was of speaking to Petronella Vivar in the Apothecarium, telling her of his life, his hopes, his disappointments, and his fears for the galaxy, conscious that he had told her those incendiary things as his valediction. He couldn't change that. But he would damn well get to the bottom of what was happening to him now. Was it a fever dream brought on by whatever had wounded him? Had Temba's sword been poisoned? He dismissed that thought immediately. No poison could lay him low. Surveying his surroundings, he could see no sign of the wolves that had chased him through the dark forests, but suddenly remembered a familiar form that had ghosted behind the face of the pack leader. For the briefest instant, it had looked like Magnus. But surely he was back on Prospero, licking his wounds after the Council of Nicaea. Something had happened to Horus on Davin's moon, but he had no idea what. His shoulder ached, and he rotated it within his armor to loosen the muscle, but the motion served only to further aggravate it. Horus set off in the direction of the river once more, still thirsty, despite knowing that he walked in an illusory realm. Cresting the rise that then began to slope gently down towards the river, Horus pulled up sharply as he saw something startling. An armored Astartes warrior floating face down in the water. Wedged in the shallows of the riverbank, the body rose and fell with the swell of the water, and Horus swiftly made his way towards it. He splashed into the river and gripped the edges of the figure's shoulder guards, turning the body over with a heavy splash. Horus gasped, seeing that the man was alive and that it was someone he knew. A beautiful man was how Loken had described him, a beautiful man who had been adored by all who knew him. The noblest hero of the Great Crusade had been another of his epithets, Hastur Sejanus. Loken marched away from the temple, angry at what his brothers had done and furious with himself. He should have known that Erebus would have had plans beyond the simple murder of the Warmaster. His veins surged with the need to do violence, but Erebus was not here, and no one could tell Loken where he was. Torgadon and Vipers marched alongside him, and even through his anger, Loken could sense his friend's astonishment at what had happened before the great gate of the Delphos. "Throne, what's happening here?" asked Vipers as they reached the top of the processional steps. "Garvey, what's happening? Are the First Captain and Little Horus our enemies now?" Loken shook his head.
"No, Nero. They are our brothers. They are simply being used, as I think we all are."
"By Erebus?" asked Torgadon.
"Erebus?" said Vipers. "What has he got to do with this?"
"Garvey thinks that Erebus is behind what's happening to the Warmaster," said Torgadon.
Loken shot him an exasperated stare.
"You're joking."
"Not this time, Nero," said Torgadon. "Taric," snapped Loken, "keep your voice down or everyone will hear."
"So what if they do, Garvey?" hissed Torgadon. "If Erebus is behind this, then everyone should know about it. We should expose him."
"And we will," promised Loken,
watching as the pinpricks of vehicle headlights appeared at the mouth of the valley they had only recently flown up.
"So what do we do?" asked Vipers.
That was the question, realized Loken. They needed more information before they could act, and they needed it now. He fought for calm, so that he could think more clearly. Loken wanted answers, but he had to know what questions to ask first. And there was one man who had always been able to cut through his confusion and steer him in the right direction. Loken set off down the steps, heading back towards the Thunderhawk. Torgadon, Vipers, and the warriors of Lacasta followed him. As he reached the bottom of the steps, he turned to them and said,
"I need you two to stay here. Keep an eye on the temple, and make sure that nothing bad happens."
"Define bad," said Vipers.
"I'm not sure," said Loken. "Just bad, you know. And contact me if you get so much of a glimpse of Erebus."
"Where are you going?" asked Torgadon.
"I'm going back to the Vengeful Spirit."
"What for?"
"To get some answers," said Loken.
"Hastur!"
cried Horus, reaching down to lift his fallen friend from the water. Sejanus was limp in his arms, though Horus could tell he lived by the pulse in his throat and the color in his cheeks. Horus dragged Sejanus from the water, wondering if his presence might be another of the strange realm's illusions, or if his old friend might in fact be a threat to him. Sejanus's chest hiked convulsively as he brought up a lungful of water, and Horus rolled him onto his side, knowing that the genhanced physique of an Astartes warrior made it almost impossible for him to drown.
"Hastur, is it really you?" asked Horus,
knowing that in this place such a question was probably meaningless, but overcome with joy to see his beloved Sejanus again. He remembered the pain he had felt when his most favored son had been hacked down upon the onyx floor of the false emperor's palace on 6319, and the chthonic bellicosity that had demanded blood vengeance. Sejanus heaved a last flood of water and propped himself up on his elbow, sucking great lungfuls of the clean air. His hand clutched at his throat as though searching for something, and he looked relieved to find that it wasn't there.
"My son," said Horus,
as Sejanus turned towards him. He was exactly as Horus remembered him, perfect in every detail. The noble face, wide-set eyes and firm, straight nose that could be a mirror for the Warmaster himself. Any thoughts that Sejanus might be a threat to him were swept away as he saw the silver shine of his eyes and knew that this surely was Hastur Sejanus. How such a thing was possible was beyond him, but he did not question this miracle, for fear that it might be snatched away from him.
"Commander," said Sejanus, rising to embrace Horus.
"Damn me, boy, it's good to see you," said Horus. "Part of me died when I lost you."
"I know, sir,"
replied Sejanus, as they released each other from the crushing embrace.
"I felt your sorrow."
"You're a sight for sore eyes, my boy,"
said Horus, taking a step back to admire his most perfect warrior.
"It gladdens my heart to see you. But how can this be? I watched you die."
"Yes," agreed Sejanus. "You did, but in truth my death was a blessing."
"A blessing?
How?"
"It opened my eyes to the truth of the universe, and freed me from the shackles of living knowledge. Death is no longer an undiscovered country, my lord. It is one from which this traveller has returned."
"How is such a thing possible?" "They sent me back to you,"
said Sejanus.
"My spirit was lost in the void, alone and dying. But I have come back to help you."
Conflicting emotions surged through Horus at the sight of Sejanus. To hear him speak of spirits and voids struck a note of warning, but to see him alive once more, even if it wasn't real, was something to be cherished.
"You say you're here to help me. Then help me to understand this place. Where are we?"
"We don't have much time," said Sejanus,
climbing the slope to the rise that overlooked the plains and forests, and taking a long look around.
"He'll be here soon."
"That's not the first time I've heard that recently,"
said Horus.
"From where else have you heard it?"
demanded Sejanus, turning back to face him with a serious expression. Horus was surprised at the vehemence of the question.
"A wolf said it to me," said Horus. "I know, I know. It sounds ridiculous. But I swear, it really did speak to me."
"I believe you, sir," said Sejanus. "That's why we need to move on."
Horus sensed evasion, a trait he had never known in Sejanus before now, and said,
"You're avoiding my question, Hastur. Now tell me where we are."
"We don't have time, my lord," urged Sejanus.
"Sejanus,"
said Horus, his voice that of the War Master, "tell me what I want to know."
"Very well," said Sejanus, "but quickly, for your body lies on the brink of death within the walls of the Delphos on Darvin."
"The Delphos? I never heard of it. And this doesn't look like Darvin."
"The Delphos is a place sacred to the Lodge of the Serpent," said Sejanus. "A place of healing. In the ancient tongues of Earth, its name means the womb of the world, where a man may be healed and renewed. Your body lies in the Axis Mundi chamber, but your spirit is no longer tied to your flesh."
"So, we're not really here?" asked Horus. "This world isn't real?"
"No."
"Then this is the warp,"
said Horus, finally accepting what he had begun to suspect.
"Yes. None of this is real,"
said Sejanus, waving his hand around the landscape.
"All this is but fragments of your will and memory that have given shape to the formless energy of the warp."
Horus suddenly knew where he had seen this land before. Remembering the wondrous geophysical relief map of Terra, they had found 10 kilometers beneath a dead world almost a decade ago. It hadn't been the Terra of their time, but one of an age long past, with green fields, clear seas, and clean air. He looked up into the sky, half expecting to see curious faces looking down on him from above, like students studying an ant colony. But the sky was empty, though it was darkening at an unnatural rate. The world around him was changing before his eyes, from the earth that had once existed to the barren wasteland of Terra. Sejanus followed his gaze and said,
"It's beginning."
"What is?"
asked Horus.
"Your mind and body are dying, and this world is beginning to collapse into chaos. That's why they sent me back, to guide you to the truth that will allow you to return to your body."
Even as Sejanus spoke, the sky began to waver, and he could see hints of the roiling sea of the Immaterium seething behind the clouds.
"You keep saying they," said Horus. "Who are they? And why are they interested in me?"
"Great intelligences dwell in the warp,"
explained Sejanus, casting wary glances at the dissolution of the sky.
"They do not communicate as we do, and this is the only way they could reach you."
"'I don't like the sound of this, Hastur,' warned Horus.
"'There is no malice in this place. There is power and potential, yes, but no malice, simply the desire to exist. Events in our galaxy are destroying this realm, and these powers have chosen you to be their emissary in their dealings with the material world.'
"'And what if I don't want to be their emissary?'
"'Then you will die,' said Sejanus. "'Only they are powerful enough to save your life now.'
"'If they're so powerful, what do they need me for?'
"'They are powerful, but they cannot exist in the material universe and must work through emissaries,' replied Sejanus. "'You are a man of strength and ambition, and they know there is no other being in the galaxy powerful enough or worthy enough to do what must be done.'
Despite his satisfaction at being so described, Horus did not like what he was hearing. He sensed no deceit in Sejanus, though a warning voice in his head reminded him that the silver-eyed warrior standing before him could not truly be Sejanus.
"'They have no interest in the material universe. It is anathema to them. They simply wish to preserve their own realm from destruction,'
continued Sejanus, as the chemical reek of the world beyond the illusion returned. And a stinking wind arose.
In return for your aid, they can give you a measure of their power and the means to realize your every ambition.
Horus saw the lurking world of brazen iron become more substantial as the warp and weft of reality began to buckle beneath his feet. Cracks of dark light shimmered through the splitting earth, and Horus could hear the sound of howling wolves drawing near.
"We have to move!" shouted Sejanus, as the wolf pack loped from a disintegrating copse of trees.
To Horus, it sounded as though their howls desperately called his name. Sejanus ran back to the river, and a shimmering flat oblong of light rose from the boiling water. Horus heard whispers and strange mutterings issuing from beyond it, and a sense of dark premonition seized him as he switched his gaze between this strange light and the wolves.
"I'm not sure about this,"
said Horus, as the sky shed fat droplets of acid rain.
"Come on! The gateway is our only way out!"
cried Sejanus, heading towards the light.
"As a great man once said, towering genius disdains the beaten path. It seeks regions hitherto unexplored." "You're quoting me back to myself?"
said Horus, as the wind blew in howling gusts.
"Why not? Your words will be quoted for centuries to come."
Horus smiled, liking the idea of being quotable, and set off after Sejanus.
"Where does this gate lead?"
shouted Horus over the wind and the howling of wolves.
"To the truth!" replied Sejanus.
The crater began to fill as the sun finally set. Hundreds of vehicles of all descriptions finally completing their journey from the Imperial deployment zone to this place of pilgrimage. The Davinites watched the arrival of these convoys with a mixture of surprise and confusion, incredulous as each vehicle was abandoned, and its passengers made their way towards the Delphos. Within the hour, thousands of people had gathered, and more were arriving every minute. Most of these new arrivals milled about in an undirected mass until the Davinites began circulating amongst them, helping to find somewhere the belongings could be set down and arranging shelter as a hard rain began to fall. Headlights stretched all the way along the forgotten causeway and through the valley to the plains below. As night closed in on Davin, songs in praise of the Warmaster filled the air, and the flickering glow of thousands of candles joined the light of the torches ringing the gold-skinned Delphos.